will welcome us when you speak for us. I am sure they will feel only pride in you." I kept my eyes fixed on them as I edged into darkness. The pain from my shoulder made me want to vomit. I watched Vindalaya's face slacken as his thoughts went elsewhere. I felt how desperately he pushed his thoughts onto Kerf as I heard the echo of a distant scream. I watched the Chalcedian scowl fade as he gazed at Dwalia. Repin had given up trying to pick up my coat from the ground. Empty-handed, she tottered over to where the others stood. There she made a knowing smile and nodded to herself as Vindalaya worked his magic, but no one took any notice of her. I bent my knees and pushed myself deeper into darkness. "My family will surely welcome you. All we own will be put at your disposal," Kerf told Dwalia. His smile was warm with certainty. "Aleria, bring her." Dwalia looked not at me, but beyond me. I turned my head. The evil delight on Aleria's face was chilling. All this time, as I'd kept watch on Dwalia and tried to move away from the firelight, she had been behind me. Now or never. I pushed hard with my good hand and managed to gain my feet, my useless arm clutched to my belly. I ran. I took three strides before Aleria caught me. She grabbed my hair and kicked my leg as if she'd been waiting her whole life for that moment. I shrieked. She shook my head by my hair as a fox shakes a rabbit, and then flung me aside. I landed on my bad shoulder, flashes of red and flashes of black. I could not find air to breathe. I could do nothing when she seized the back of my shirt and dragged me almost to my feet. "Walk," she shouted at me. "Walk, or I'll kick you again." It was hard to obey and impossible to defy her. She was bigger and stronger than me and hadn't been beaten recently. She kept her grip on my garments and held me too high. We were halfway to Dwalia, me struggling to balance on my toes, when I realized that my shoulder was a dull red ache, but I could move my arm again. So I had that. By the pillars, Dwalia was arranging her ducklings to her liking.
"I will go first," she announced, as if anyone else could have. "I will grip Vindalaya's hand, and he will hold Kerf's."
She smiled warmly at the nodding Chalcedian, and I understood. Those were the two most important to her own survival. She wished to be certain her magic man and the warrior with a home in Chalced arrived with her.
"Then the brat. Kerf, hold it tight to her, not her hand. Remember that she bites. Grab the back of her neck, that's right. Aleria, you are last. Take her by her upper arm and hold tight."
This Aleria was pleased to do, and I could only be weakly glad that it was not my bad shoulder. Kerf gripped the back of my neck, and any kindliness he previously had shown toward me was gone. He was Vindalaya's puppet again.
"Wait, am I last?"
Repin demanded. Dwalia looked at her coldly.
"You are not last. You are unnecessary. You would not fetch the firewood. You chose to be useless. Aleria, go fetch that coat. It may be worth money in Chalced, and the Repin's pack."
Repin's eyes were huge in her wan face as Aleria released me and ran to obey. The Chalcedian's grip on me was sure. Aleria moved swiftly. Did she wish to show how useful she was? In a moment, she was back, Repin's pack slung over one shoulder, and the heavy coat that once had been white and mine draped over her arm. She seized my upper arm in a pinching grip.
"You can't leave me here. I need my pack. Don't leave me."
Repin's pale face was cadaverous in the light of the fire. Her bitten arm was curled to her chest. She pawed at Aleria, trying to seize Aleria's free hand with her good one. Aleria turned her face away from her and clutched my former coat to her chest, curling her hand out of Repin's reach. Her grip on my arm tightened. I wonder if she hardened her heart to leave Repin, or if it was a relief. Perhaps she was simply glad that she wasn't the one being abandoned. I saw now how Dwalia ruled. Cruelty to one of her followers meant the others could breathe more easily for a moment.
There was no loyalty between Lurix, only fear of Dwalia and desire for what she might bestow on them.
Please!
Repin shrieked to the night. Vindelire made a small sound. For an instant, his concentration was broken and Kerf's grip on my neck loosened.
She's useless, Dwalia growled. She's dying, she's whining, and she's consuming resources that are already scarce. Don't question my decisions, Vindelire. Look what happened to all of us the last time you did not obey my commands. Look how many dead, and all your fault. Pay attention to me and hold tight or you too will be left behind.
Kerf's grip on me tightened, and Alaria's fingers ground the flesh of my arm against the bone. I suddenly grasped the danger.
We should not do this. We should follow the road. It must go somewhere. The standing stones are dangerous. We may not come out, or we may emerge as mad as Kerf.
My shouted warnings went unheeded. Dwalia pressed her gloved hand to the stone's carved face. It seemed to draw her in like a slice of ginger sinking into warm honey. The light from our abandoned campfire showed her sliding into the stone. Vindelire followed, panting with terror as his hand, his wrist, his elbow vanished into stone. He whined as he was drawn in.
"We swim with the dead ones!"
Kerf shouted, grinning his madman's grimace.
On to the fallen palace of a dead duke!
He seemed to enter the pillar more slowly than Vindelire had, as if the stone resisted him. I hung back, but his grip on my neck stayed tight, even when the rest of him had vanished into the stone. I looked up as I was dragged toward the pillar and lost my breath in horror at what I saw. The additional marking on the stone was not new. It was not scored as deeply into the stone as the original runes, but there was no mistaking its intent. Someone had deliberately marked a deep, straight scratch through the rune as if to forbid or warn anyone who chose to use that face of the portal.
Da!
I cried out, a desperate call that no one could hear.
Da! Help me!
In the next moment, my cheek touched the cold surface, and I was pulled into tarry blackness.
Chapter 4. Chael said, "Because of our studies of many old scrolls, including translations we have done, I am convinced that the legendary elderlings of our myths and legends were a very real people who occupied a large territory for many generations before their cities and culture eventually fell into decay, long before Buckkeep Castle was founded. Additional information gained from a library of what we call skill cubes has only convinced us that we are correct. Why did the Elderlings, a people of wisdom and powerful magic, fail and disappear from our world? Can we tie that failing to the vanishing of the dragons, another event for which we have no explanation? And now that both dragons and perhaps elderlings have returned to the world, how does that affect the future of humankind? And what of our legends of an ancient alliance between Farseer and elderlings, the very alliance that King Verity sought to revive when he led his expedition to the Rain Wilds? Were they living elderlings he encountered, or the stored memories of what they had been? Questions that we may find the answers to if we continue to mine the memory cubes for information."
Vanishing Elderlings, Shade Fullstar.
"My mother used to do this to me when she wanted to move me."
A dim recollection. A den. A mother who carried me by the scruff of my neck. Not my thought, but it was a thought and the first one I had. Someone gripped hair, skin, and shirt collar. The collar was the part that was choking me. I was dragged up and out of a mire as someone protested, "There isn't room! Leave her! There isn't room!" The blackness was absolute. Air on my face. I blinked my eyes to see if they were truly open. They were. No stars, no distant firelight. Nothing. Just dark. And something thick trying to pull me back down. I was abruptly glad for the choking grip on my collar. In panic, I clutched one-handed at someone's shirt and crawled up and on to Kerf. He was prone on his side beneath me. I lifted my head and it hit against something. Worse, someone had hold of my arm and was pulling on it as they crawled up to join me. The man beneath me shifted onto his back. I fell off him to lie wedged between him and a stone wall. It was a snug fit, and instinctively I pushed at him, trying to gain more room. But I could not move his bulk, and I heard Elaria gasp, and then utter small shriek after shriek as she scrabbled up to take my place on top of Kerf. The shriek turned into gasped words. "Let go! Let go of me!" She was thrashing on top of Kerf.
"You're kicking me!"
Vindalaya protested.
"Let go!"
Elaria cried.
"I'm not touching you! Stop kicking!"
Dwalia ordered her.
"Vindalaya, get off me!"
"I can't! I'm stuck! There's no room!"
He was panting with terror. Where were we? What had happened to us? Dwalia tried for a tone of command and failed. She was breathless.
"Silence! All!"
"I'm sick."
I heard Vindalaya gag.
"That was awful. They were all grabbing at me. I want to go home. I can't do this. I hate this. I need to go home."
He blubbered like a small child.
"Let go of me!"
Elaria, her voice gone shrill.
"Help me! I'm sinking. Please make room. I can't climb past you."
I heard and smelled Repin. The infection in her arms stank. She had probably broken the wound open in her struggle.
"My arm! I can't climb out. Pull me up, someone. Don't leave me here. Don't leave me with them."
Where were we?
"Be calm. Discover what has happened before you try to make a plan."
I felt Wolffather's sturdiness suffuse me. My breathing had become bellows in my chest, but his voice was so calm in my mind.
"Listen. Touch. Smell. What can you discover?"
It was hard to be calm with the slapping, panting struggle going on right beside me. Elaria begged,
"Let go! There's no room! Don't pull me back! Ah!"
Repin did not shriek. She gave a long moan that was suddenly quenched by a sound like a heavy stone pulled free from muck. Only Elaria's panting broke the silence.
"She was pulled back down into the stone."
More a statement than a question from Dwalia, and with it I recalled that she had dragged us into a skill pillar.
I had to push her away. There's no more room. You said to leave her. It's not my fault."
Elaria sounded more defensive than sorry.
"Be silent!"
Dwalia's voice was still pinched with breathlessness.
"I speak! Vindalaya, get off me!"
"I am sorry. I am stuck here. Kerf pushed me onto you as he crawled up. I can't budge. A stone presses down on me."
He was on the edge of hysteria.
"I am so sick. I cannot see. Am I blind? Lyngstor Dwalia, am I blind?"
"No, it is dark, you oaf. Don't dare vomit on me. You are crushing me. Give me room."
I heard a struggle of shifting bodies. Vindalaya whimpered.
"There's no space for me to move. I am crushed too."
"If you cannot be helpful, be still. Chalcedian?"
She was gasping for air. Vindalaya was not a small person, and she was trapped beneath him.
"Kerf!"
He giggled. It was a terrible sound coming from a man's deep chest in the darkness.
"Stop that! Dwalia, he's touching me!"
Valeria was outraged and terrified. Kerf giggled again, and I felt him tug his arm from under me. He lifted it, giving me a tiny bit more room, and I surmised that he embraced Valeria against him.
"Nice,"
he said in a throaty voice, and I felt him lift his hips against her.
"Stop,"
she begged him, but his reply was a growl, followed by a low chuckle. The muscles of his upper arm were pressed against me, and I felt them tighten as he snugged Valeria closer to him. His breathing deepened. Beside me, he began a rhythmic shifting that shoved me solidly against the wall. Valeria began to weep.
"Ignore him,"
Dwalia ordered her coldly.
"He's trying to rape me,"
she squeaked.
"He's..."
"He doesn't have enough room, so ignore him. He can't get his own trousers down, let alone yours. Pretend he's a little dog, infatuated with your leg."
Was there a cruel satisfaction in Dwalia's voice? Did she revel in Ilaria's humiliation?
"We are trapped here, and you are squawking about a man touching you? Scarcely a real danger."
Ilaria responded with a frightened keening that kept pace with Kerf's thudding against her.
"The girl, B, did she come through? Is she alive?"
Dwalia demanded. I kept my silence. I had wriggled my sore arm free, and although my injured shoulder protested, I was groping to discover the confines of our prison. Stone beneath me. To the left of me, Kerf's body. To my right, a wall of stone as far as I could grope. When I reached up, I could brush my fingertips against more stone. It was worked stone, smooth as a polished floor. I explored with my feet. More stone. Even if I had been alone in this space, I could not have sat up. Where were we? The tempo of the Chalcedian's jerking was speeding up, and with it, his open-mouthed gasping.
"Ilaria, feel around. Did the girl come through?"
"She must have. Oh, I dragged myself through by holding on to her."
Ilaria's voice was going smaller and higher. The Chalcedian continued to heave himself about.
"It's disgusting,"
she wailed.
"He's mouthing my face. He stinks. Stop it,"
she shrieked, but the Chalcedian began to grunt under her.
"Can you feel her? Is she alive?"
Dwalia persisted. I lay still. Despite Kerf's passionate rocking, I felt her groping hand. I held my breath. She touched my face and then my chest.
"She's here. She's not moving, but her body is warm. Vindalaya, make him stop this."
"I can't. I'm sick. I'm so sick."
"Vindalaya, you'd best recall that I and only I give you your orders. Ilaria, be silent."
"So many of them were in there,"
Vindalaya groaned.
"They were all pulling at me. I'm so sick."
"Be sick silently,"
Dwalia snapped. Ilaria was gasping in horror. She did not speak again, but I heard the small weeping sound she made and the deep groan of the Chalcedian when he finally reached some sort of satisfaction. She tried to wriggle away from him, but I felt his arm muscles tighten and knew he held her there. It was as well for me. I did not want her to roll off him and onto me.
"Feel about as much as you can,"
Dwalia commanded.
"Can anyone feel an opening in this tomb?"
It was a poor choice of words.
"Tomb,"
Vindalaya repeated, and gave a trailing moan of despair.
"Silence,"
she wheezed at him.
"Feel about over your head. Is there any opening?"
I heard them moving in the darkness, heard the scraping brush of fingers against stone, the scuff of boots scraping more stone. I remained still.
"Anything?"
Dwalia demanded of the darkness.
"No,"
Ilaria responded sullenly. "Only stone. Everywhere I touch, I can barely lift my head. Have you any room next to you?" The Chalcedian's muscles had gone slack, and by his stentorian breathing, I deduced he had fallen asleep. Madness was perhaps a mercy in some situations.
Would I allow Vindalaya to lie on top of me if I could be anywhere else?
Dwalia demanded. A silence. Then Alaria suggested, perhaps you should take us back to where we were.
Unfortunately, as the Chalcedian emerged, he pushed me to one side and shoved Vindalaya on top of me. He now lies on top of the portal stone. I cannot reach it from where I am.
We are packed like pickled fish in a cask,
Vindalaya observed sadly. More softly, he added,
I suppose we will all die here.
What?
Alaria demanded in a half-shriek.
Die here? Starving to death in the dark?
Well, we can't get out,
Vindalaya responded morosely.
Be silent,
Dwalia ordered them. But it was too late. Alaria broke. She began weeping in gasps, and after a few moments I heard Vindalaya's muffled sobs. Die here. Who would die first? A scream started to swell inside my chest.
That is not a useful thought,
Wolffather rebuked me.
Breathe. Quietly.
I felt panic swell in me and then be quashed under his sternness.
Think how to escape. Do you think you could enter the stone alone? Could you reach under the Chalcedian and open the passageway to return us to the forest?
I'm not sure.
Try.
I'm afraid to try. What if I get stuck in the stone? What if I come out alone somewhere?
What if you stay here and starve? After, of course, the others go mad and attack one another. Now, try.
When I had slid off Kerf, I had landed on my back. I wriggled to one side. I had to roll onto my sore shoulder to do so. And it was that hand and arm that I had to try to wedge under Kerf and Alaria's combined weight. I tried to do it slowly, sliding my hand under the small of his back where it did not press so hard against the stone. I made a small sound of pain, and Alaria's sniffling stopped.
What's that?
She cried and reached down to me.
She's moving. Bee's alive and awake. And I bite,
I reminded her, and she snatched her hand away. Now that they knew I was awake, there was no point in being secretive. I shoved my hand as far under Kerf as it would go. He shifted slightly, pinching my arm under him, then belched and went back to snoring. My shoulder burned as I worked my hand deeper under Kerf, scraping it over gritty stone. I heard my own fearful panting and closed my mouth to breathe through my nose. It was quieter, but I was still just as terrified. What if I touched the rune and was suddenly sucked in? Could it drag me in past Kerf? Would he and Alaria fall in with me, as if I had opened a door under us? The terror put pressure on my bladder. I blocked it. I blocked everything except the effort of pushing my hand across stone. The stone surface under my fingers suddenly became a small indentation. I cautiously explored it with my fingertips. It was the rune.
Do you feel anything? Can you make anything happen?
I tried. I didn't want to, but I pushed my fingers into the rune and rubbed the tips against the graven lines of it.
Nothing. Nothing happens, Wolffather.
Very well. We should think of something else, then.
His words were calm, but beneath them I felt his simmering fear. Dragging my arm out from under Kerf was more painful than pushing it beneath him had been. Once my arm was free, I knew a sudden surge of panic. Everything was touching me. Kerf's warm body, the unyielding stone below me, the stone alongside my body. I desperately needed to stand up, to stretch, to breathe cool air.
Don't struggle,
Wolffather insisted.
Struggling only makes a snare go tighter. Be still and think. Think.
I tried, but everything was still touching me. Alaria was weeping again. Kerf was snoring, his ribs moved against me with every breath he took. My tunic had twisted around me, binding one of my arms. I was too warm. I was thirsty. I made a small noise in the back of my throat without intending to. Another sound rose in me, a scream that wanted to get out.
No, none of that. Close your eyes, cub. Be with me. We are in a forest. Remember the cool night smells of a forest? Lie very still. Be with me.
Wolffather pulled me into his memories. I was in a forest. Dawn was coming, and we were snug in a den.
Time to sleep, he insisted. Sleep.
I must have slept. When I woke, I held tight to the calm he had given me. I had nothing else to cling to. In the blackness, I measured the passage of time by the behavior of my fellow prisoners. Kerf woke when Alaria became hysterical. He put his arms around her and crooned to her, perhaps a Chalcedian lullaby. She stilled after a time. Later, Dwalia burst into shrieking, impotent fury when Vindalaya pissed on her.
I held it as long as I could,
he wailed, and the smell of urine made me want to piss as well. Dwalia whispered something to him, her voice as soft and deadly as a snake's hiss, and he began to sob. Then his sounds stopped, and I decided he slept. Alaria was quiet. Kerf began to sing, not a lullaby, but some sort of marching song. He stopped abruptly mid-verse.
Little girl, Bee, are you alive?
I am, I answered because I was glad he had stopped singing.
I am very confused. When we walked through stone, I was certain we were dead. But if we are not dead, then this will not be a good way for you to die. I think I could reach your neck. Would you like me to strangle you? It will not be fast, but it is a faster death than starving.
How thoughtful. No, thank you, not yet.
You should not wait too long. I will become weak, and it will be unpleasant in here soon. Piss, shit, people going mad.
No, I heard something. Hush!
I know my words are sad to hear, but I only seek to warn you. I may be strong enough to snap your neck. That might be faster.
No, not yet. Not yet. What was I saying? Then, from far away, a sound. Listen, do you hear that? Alaria stirred at my words. Hear what? She demanded.
Do you hear something?
Dwalia snapped at me.
Be silent!
I roared at them in my father's angry voice, and they obeyed. We all listened. The sounds were faint. Slow hooves clopping on cobblestones. A woman's voice lifted in a brief sing-song chant.
Is it a prayer?
Laria wondered.
It's an early peddler. She sings. Bread fresh baked this morning. Bread warm from the oven.
Kerf sounded sentimental.
Help us!
Alaria's desperate scream was so shrill, my ears rang with it.
Help us, oh, help us, we are trapped!
When she finally stopped shrieking for lack of breath, my ears were ringing. I strove to hear the bread woman's song or the clopping hooves, but I heard nothing.
She is gone,
Vindalaya said sadly.
We are in a city, Kerf declared. Only cities have breadmongers at dawn, selling wares in the street.
He paused for a moment, and then said,
I thought we were dead. I thought that was why you wished to come to the fallen palace of the dead duke, to be dead here. Do breadmongers still sing when they are dead? I do not think so. What need have the dead of fresh bread?
Silence greeted his question. I did not know what the others were thinking, but I pondered his previous words. A fallen palace. How much stone was on top of our tomb?
So we are not dead,
he reasoned laboriously.
But we will be soon if we cannot escape. But perhaps as the city wakes, we will hear other people, and perhaps they will hear us if we shout for help. So be silent for now.
Dwalia warned us,
be silent and listen.
I will tell you when to shout for help, and we will all shout together.
We waited in suffocating silence. From time to time we heard the muffled sounds of a city. A temple bell rang. An ox bellowed. Once we thought we heard a woman calling a child. At that, Dwelia bade us all shout for help with one voice. But it seemed to me that the sounds were never very close, and I wondered if we were on a hill above a city, rather than in the city itself. After a time, Vindelire pissed again, and I think Ilaria did too. The smell was getting worse, piss and sweat and fear. I tried to imagine I was in my bed at Withywood's. It was dark in the room. Soon my father would come to look in on me. He always thought I was asleep when he looked in my room late at night before going to his own bed. I stared up at blackness and imagined his step in the corridor. I was beginning to see dots of light from staring into the blackness so long. Then I blinked and realized that one of the dots was now a narrow stripe. I stared at it, not daring to hope. Slowly I lifted my foot as far as it would go. It blocked part of the light. When I lowered my foot, the light reappeared, stronger.
I can see light,
I whispered.
Where?
Near my feet, I said. But by then the light had started to slink in. I could see how uneven the blocks were that confined us. Worked stone, yes, but tumbled in a heap around us rather than something built.
I can't see it,
Dwelia said as if I were lying.
Nor I, Kerf confirmed. My woman is in my way.
I am not your woman. Ilaria was outraged.
You have slept on top of me? You've pissed on me? I claim you.
My lifted foot could barely reach the slot of light. I pointed my toe and pushed. I heard gravel fall outside our prison, and the crack widened slightly. I rolled onto my side as much as I could and pushed against Kerf to slide myself closer to the light. I could press my whole foot against the stone below the light, and I did. More and larger rock shards fell, some rattling against my boot. The light grew stronger. I kicked at it savagely. The shaft of light enlarged to the size of my hand. I battered my feet against it as if I were dancing in a hill of biting ants. No more gravel fell. I kicked at the stone that roofed that wall, to no avail. I stopped when I had no strength left and became aware that the others had been shouting questions and encouragement. I didn't care. I refused to let Wolffather's calmness reach me. I stared up at the dimly lit ceiling of my tomb and sobbed. The Chalcedian moved, shoving me aside to lift his arms past his head and brace them against the stone. He groaned and suddenly shifted hard against me. His hip pushed into my ribs, wedging me against the walls so I could scarcely breathe. Ilaria was squeaking and squealing as he pressed her against the ceiling. He drew up his knee, crushing me harder, and then with an audible grunt, he kicked out suddenly and hard. Grit fell and rock dust sifted into my eyes and up my nose and settled on my lips. Kerf was still pinning me, and I could not get my hand to my face to rub it away. It stuck to the tears on my cheeks and settled between my collar and neck. Then, as the dust was settling, and I could almost draw a clean breath, he did it again. A vertical line of light suddenly added to the first one.
It's a block of stone. Try again, little one. This time, push, not kick. I'll help you. Put your feet down low at the bottom of it.
What if it falls on us?
A faster death, Kerf said.
I wriggled and slid my body closer to the line of light. I bent my knees, set my feet low on the block. The Chalcedian shifted his big boot between and slightly above my feet.
Push,
he said, and I did. Stone grated grudgingly, but it moved. A rest, and then we pushed again. The crack was a hand breadth wide. Another push and the stone fetched up against something. We pushed three more times before the stone moved, and then it slewed to the left. Another push, and it was easier. I shifted my body to get more purchase. The afternoon sunlight that had found us was fading toward evening by the time the opening was large enough for me to wriggle out. I went feet first, squirming blindly out of a gap barely large enough for me to pass, scraping skin off my hip and tearing my tunic. I sat up, brushing dust and grit from my face. I heard the others shouting, demanding that I move more stone, that I tell them where we were. I ignored them. I didn't care where we were. I could breathe and no one else was touching me. I drew deep breaths of cool air, wiped my sleeve across my gritty face, and rolled my good shoulder. I was out.
What can you see?
Dwalia was furious with desperation. Where are we? I looked around me. Ruins, I supposed. I could now see what our tomb had been, and it was not at all what I had thought it was. Great blocks of stones had fallen, first one pillar to the floor, then a great slab of stone had collapsed part way across the fallen pillar, and then other pieces of stones had tumbled around them. I looked up at the evening sky, past the jagged remains of walls, and down at more etched runes. There was another skill pillar here, set into the floor. I stepped gingerly away from it. The others were shouting contradictory orders at me, to fetch help, to say what I saw. I didn't respond. I heard the temple bell ring again in the distance. I took 3 steps out of sight, squatted, and relieved myself. As I stood, I heard stone grating and saw the Chalcedian's legs emerging from the enlarged opening. I hastily pulled up my leggings and watched as he braced his feet and levered the stone away. Shrieks from inside of, "Be careful!" and "You'll bring it down on us!" went unheeded. "I should run," I whispered to myself. "Not yet," Wolffather whispered in my mind. "Remain with the danger you know. The Chalcedian has mainly been kind to you. If we are in Chalced, you do not speak the language or know their ways. Maybe luck will favor us and the stones fall on all the others. Hide and watch." I moved back among the tumbled stones and crouched where I could see, but not be seen. Kerf wriggled out on his back, kicking and scraping and grunting as he heaved himself along. He emerged powdered with grey dust and grit, looking like a statue called to life. His hips freed, he shifted onto his side, twisting like a snake to maneuver first one shoulder and then the other out, and sat up, blinking in the late afternoon light. His pale eyes were startling in his grey stone face. He licked dust from his lips, his red tongue another oddity, and looked about himself, then stepped up onto a block of stone and surveyed the scene. I crouched lower.
"Is it safe?"
Hilaria called, but she had already thrust her feet out of the opening. Smaller and lither than the Chalcedian, but just as dirty, she squirmed out without waiting for any answer, then sat up, groaning, and wiped rock dust from her face.
"Where are we?"
she demanded. Kerf grinned.
"Chael said, I am almost home. I know this place, although it has changed greatly. Here we once mourned my grandfather. The Duke's throne was at the end of a great hall. Over there, I think. This is what remains of the old Duke's palace, after the dragons brought it tumbling down around his ears."
He sneezed several times, wiped his face on his arm, and then nodded to himself.
"Yes. The Duchess proclaimed it an evil place and swore it would never be rebuilt."
He frowned slightly, as if summoning the memory was difficult or painful. He spoke slowly, almost dreamily.
"Duke Elik vowed it would be the first structure he raised again, and that he would rule from it."
Hilaria struggled to her feet.
"Chael said," she whispered to herself. He spun to her and grinned. "Our home! My mother will be pleased to meet you. She has longed for me to bring home a woman, to share the tasks of the household with her and my sisters, and to bear my children. I am not your wife." "Not yet. But if you prove yourself a hard worker and a maker of strong children, then perhaps I shall wed you. Many prizes of war become wives." "Eventually."
"I am not a prize of war," she declared.
Kerf shook his head and rolled his eyes, bemused by her ignorance. Hilaria looked as if she wanted to shriek, scratch him, or run away. She did none of those things, but turned her attention to the next pair of feet emerging from the stone tomb. Vindalaya's feet were kicking and scuffing as he tried to emerge.
I'm stuck,
he cried in a panic-stricken voice.
Get out of my way!
Dwalia's voice was muted.
I told you to let me go first! There wasn't room.
He was already tearful.
I had to go first to get off you. You said, get off me, and this was the only way I could get off you.
She cursed him, her obscenities muffled by stone. Vindalaya did not seem to be making much progress. I took advantage of the noise to retreat farther from all of them, behind the round of a fallen column. From there I could peer back to see what was happening, but not be seen. Vindalaya was wedged. He drummed his heels helplessly on the ground as if he were a child having a tantrum. Stuck. Good, I thought savagely. Let him be the plug that bottles up Dwalia forever. Despite any kindly feelings he had toward me, I knew he was the real danger. If I fled, Dwalia could never catch me, but if Vindalaya set the Chalcedian on me, I was doomed.
Brother, my brother, please move the stone and free me.
I didn't make a sound as I crouched there, watching with one eye. Kerf stepped over to the stone.
Where the dust?
He called to Vindalaya and stooped to set his shoulder to the blocking stone. I heard it grate against the ancient floor and saw smaller stones and grit vanish in a crack that opened in the top of the rock pile as he did so. Dwalia screamed, but the rocks that fell would do no more than bruise her. Kerf seized Vindalaya's thick legs and dragged him out. Vindalaya jammed for a moment and howled as Kerf grunted and pulled him out anyway. I saw him sit up, grey with dust, and with a bleeding scrape on the side of his face.
I'm free,
he announced as if no one else would know it.
Get out of my way,
Dwalia shouted. I did not wait to see her emerge. Ducking low, I crept away. I threaded my way through the maze of fallen stone, silent as a mouse. The slanting sunlight of a spring evening created shapes from the shadows. I came to a place where a fallen wall leaned against a collapsed column like a stone tent and crept into it.
Stay hidden. It is easier for them to see motion and hear your footsteps than to search this rubble.
I was alone and hungry and thirsty in a city far from home where I did not speak the language. But I was free. I'd escaped.
Chapter 5. The Bargain.
A snake is in a stone bowl. There is soup around it. It smells bad, and then I know it is not soup. It is very dirty water, full of snake piss and waste. A creature comes to the bowl, and suddenly I see how big the snake is and the bowl. The snake is many times longer than the creature is tall. The creature reaches through bars around the bowl to scoop up some of the dirty water. He slurps some of the filthy water and smiles with an ugly, wide mouth. I do not like to look at him. He is so wrong. The serpent coils in on itself and tries to bite him. He laughs and shuffles away.
Dream Journal of B. Farcia. As comfortable as the elderling robes might be, I did not feel decently clad for my meeting with the keepers until I was in my own clothes again. As I snugged my leather belt tight and buckled it, I noticed I had gained 2 notches of travel since I'd left Buckkeep. My leather waistcoat would function as light armor. Not that I expected anyone to knife me, but one never knew. The small items in my concealed pockets would expedite any deadly task of my own. I smiled to realize that someone had unloaded my secret pockets before my garments were laundered, and then restored all the items to their proper location. I said nothing to Spark as I tugged my waistcoat straight, and then patted the pocket that concealed a very fine garrote. She quirked her brows at me. It was enough. I vacated the room to allow Spark to attend to Lady Amber's dressing and coiffing. I found Lant ready and Perseverance keeping him company, and chased a foggy memory of a conversation between the two, then let it go.
Done was done. Lant no longer seemed to fear me, and as for Shade's instructions to him, well, that would demand a private conversation. "So, are we ready?" Lant asked as he slid a small, flat-handled knife into a sheath concealed at his hip. It startled me. Who was this man? The answer came to me. This was the Lant that Riddle and Nettle had both admired and enjoyed. I understood suddenly why Shade had asked him to watch over me. It was not flattering, but it was oddly reassuring. Perseverance had a worried frown. "Am I to be seated with you at the dinner? It seems very strange." In the space of a few months, he had gone from being a stable boy on my estate to being my serving man, and companion, if I were truthful. "I don't know. If they send you and Spark to another table, be sure to stay close to her." He nodded grimly.
"Sir, may I ask you something?"
"What is it?" I asked guardedly. I was on edge for our meeting with the keepers. He shot Lant a sideways look as if shy about asking his question.
"About Madge Gray. Sometimes you call him Fool, but he's being Lady Amber now."
"He is," I conceded, and waited. Lant was silent, as intrigued by the Fool's many guises as the lad was.
"And Ash is Spark now."
I nodded. "True, also."
"And Spark is a girl."
I nodded again. He folded his lips in as if to imprison his question. Then he blurted,
"Do you feel at all odd about it? Uncomfortable?"
I laughed. "I've known him for many years in many guises. He was King Shrewd's jester when I was a boy, the Fool, then Lord Golden. Madge Gray, and now Lady Amber, all different, yet always my friend." I reached for honesty. "But when I was your age, it would have bothered me a great deal. It doesn't now because I know who he is, and who I am, and who we are to each other. That doesn't change no matter what name he wears or what garb he dons, whether I am Holder Tom Badgerlock or Prince Fitzchivalry Farseer. I know he's my friend." He gave a sigh of relief.
"Then it's all right that it doesn't matter to me about Spark. I saw it didn't bother you, and I decided it need not bother me."
He shook his head, perplexed, and added,
"When she's being Spark, she's pretty."
"She is," Lant said quietly. I fought to keep from smiling.
"So that's who she really is, a girl named Spark."
That was a harder question. Spark is whoever she is. Sometimes that's Ash. It's like being a father and a son and perhaps a husband, all different facets of the same person. He nodded.
"But it was easier to talk to Ash. We had better jokes."
A tap at the door announced Lady Amber and Spark. Lady Amber had gone to every possible effort to be dazzling, and had succeeded. The long skirt and lacy beribboned blouse with the embroidered waistcoat were dated by buckkeep standards. Amber, or more likely Spark, had given special attention to the rouge that shaped her lips and the powder that concealed her scars. Her blind eyes were outlined in black, emphasizing their opacity. Spark was a pretty girl, but no more than that today. She had chosen to present herself in a way that would not invite too much attention. Her hair, released from Ash's warrior tail, hung in black waves to her shoulders. Her high-collared blouse was the color of butterscotch, and the simple smock over it denied she had breasts or a waist. Amber wore an amused smile. Could she sense how Purr and Lant were gazing at them, dumbfounded? "The clothes look much better on you than they did on Lady Time," I complimented her.
"I hope they also smell better,"
was the Fool's response.
"Who is Lady Time?"
Lant asked. For a moment, the silence held. Then both the Fool and I burst into laughter. I had almost recovered when the Fool gasped,
"Your father!"
And we were both lost again to merriment. Lant was torn between confusion and offense.
"I don't understand what is funny,"
Spark queried.
"We raided an old woman's wardrobe for these clothes."
It's a very long tale,
was Amber's ladylike response.
A hint. Lady Time's chamber had a secret entry to Shade's workroom. When he chose to occasionally emerge from hiding in the old days, he moved as Lady Time.
Lant's mouth hung slightly ajar.
Lady Time was one of your father's most inspired ploys, but it must be a tale for another time. For now, we must descend.
Do not we wait until we are summoned? I asked.
No, for Rainwild courtesies are founded on Bingtown ways rather than on Jamalian aristocracy. They are more egalitarian and pragmatic and direct. Here you are Prince Fitzchivalry, and they will expect you to have the last word. But I know more of their ways than you do. Please let me negotiate.
Negotiate what?
Our passage through their territory, and possibly beyond.
We have nothing to offer them in exchange for our passage, I pointed out. Much of my coin and several other precious items had been lost in the bear attack.
I will think of something, she replied.
And he won't be offering healing to anyone. I can't. She raised her delicately outlined brows at me.
Who would know that better than me?
She replied and held out a gloved hand. I stepped forward and hooked it onto my arm. I saw Lant grinning as Perseverance stepped forward and offered his crooked arm to Spark. She looked startled, but accepted it. I took a deep breath. And off we go, I warned them. A serving girl waited at the foot of the stairs to guide us into a sumptuous and elegant chamber. There were no tapestries, no figured rugs, but the walls themselves and the floor underfoot did not need them. We seemed to be dining in an open field, surrounded by a vista of autumn hills in green and gold. We trod on a grassy sward with tiny wildflowers speckled among the verdant green. Only the sensation of stone underfoot and the still air spoiled the illusion. I heard Spark whisper a description to Amber, who smiled wistfully. Four tables were arranged in an open square with the guests' chairs directly inward. There was no head of the table, no seat of authority. Some of the keepers were already here, standing or seated in small groups. They were a striking reminder of the tapestry of elderlings that had graced my boyhood bedchamber. Tall and slender they were, with eyes of gold or copper or sparkling blue. All were scaled, some more heavily than others, and each was marked fantastically in patterns that were as precise as the feathers on a bird or the colors on a butterfly's wings. They were beautiful and alien, wondrous to behold. I thought of the children I had healed and of the Rainwilders I had glimpsed in my days here. Their changes were as often grotesque as pretty. The differences were striking, and the fate of those randomly affected by contact with dragons was appalling. Our servant escort had vanished. We stood smiling and uncertain. Should I dismiss Spark and Perseverance, or were they part of the six duchies' emissaries that the invitation had addressed? Spark was describing the room, the people and their garments to Amber in a low murmur. I did not interrupt. General Rapscal stood tall even among the tall elderlings and was broader of shoulder than many. He wore a less martial air tonight, being clothed in a tunic of blue with yellow trousers and soft blue footwear. He carried no weapons that I could see. I knew that did not mean he was unarmed. With him were the two elderlings I had seen following his commands earlier. One of them, I surmised, was Case. Both were scaled in orange, and the eyes they turned toward us were copper, and both were heavily muscled. I'd wager they could brawl hard if provoked. The blue elderling woman wore her wings outside her long tunic tonight, folded smoothly to her back. Their feathery scales were a patterned display of blues and silvers, with touches of black and white. I wondered at the weight of them on her slender, once human frame. Her long black hair was confined in rows of braids that were interrupted with beads and small silver charms. The elderling man beside her had green scaling and dark hair. He looked directly at us, spoke to his mate, and then moved toward us, purposefully. I tried not to stare at the odd pattern of scales on his cheek as he greeted me.
"Prince Fitzchivalry, I should like to introduce myself. I'm Tats. Timara and I thank you for what you did for our daughter. Her feet and legs are still sore, but she finds it much easier to walk."
I am glad I was able to help her. He had not offered his hand, and so I kept mine at my side.
Timara spoke.
"I thank you. For the first time in many weeks, she can sleep without pain."
She hesitated, and then added,
"She said that her chest feels different. She had not complained of it, but now she says that it is easier to breathe with her skin not so tight."
Her inflection made the statement a question. I smiled and said only, "I am glad she is more comfortable." I had a vague recollection of a keel bone such as a bird might have. Had their child been developing it? It did not seem tactful to admit that I could not clearly recall what the skill had done to her through me. Timara's earnest gaze met my eyes and then traveled to Amber.
"Would that you could be rewarded as you deserve," she said softly.
A mellifluous chime sounded. Timara smiled at me again.
"Well, we are to be seated now. Thank you again, and always."
They moved gracefully away from me, and I became aware that while we had spoken, other elderlings had arrived. Once I had been an assassin with an edge, constantly aware of my surroundings. I wasn't so tonight, and it was not just that my skill walls were so tight. I had lost the habit of extreme alertness. When had I last been the competent assassin that Shade had trained? Not for a long time. When I had lived at Withywoods with Molly, that would have pleased me. Here and now, it seemed a serious failure. I spoke low to Lant. "Stay alert. If you notice anything untoward, let me know immediately." He gave me an incredulous glance that threatened to become a smile before he gained control of his face. Together, we moved in an unhurried way toward the tables. I saw no indication of any protocol related to seating. King Rain and Queen Malta had entered, but were engaged in deep conversation with a lanky blue-scaled elderling. Fron, looking much livelier now, was with them. Their talk seemed to involve us, for twice he gestured toward us. Where were we expected to sit? Awkward, and potentially a social disaster. Timara glanced over at us, spoke to her mate, and then hastened back to us.
"You may sit wherever you please. Would you like to be together, or to mingle?"
I longed to exchange a glance with Amber. Instead, I patted her hand on my arm fondly, and she immediately replied,
"Together, if we may."
"Of course." But I did not see five adjacent seats until Timara matter-of-factly called out,
"Alam, Sylve, Jerd, Harrikin, bump down and make some room."
The elderlings so addressed laughed at her abrupt manner and promptly shifted their seating to free up a rank of five chairs.
"There, please,"
Timara invited, and we were seated. Timara and her mate took seats as Malta and Rain joined us at the table. No royal procession into the room, no announcements of names, no titles for the keepers, no variance in rank was apparent, except for General Rapskull. Servants brought dishes of food and set them down to be passed for the elderlings to serve themselves. The meat was wild game, venison or bird. The bread was not plentiful, but there were four fish dishes and three kinds of root vegetables. The menu told me that Kelsingrar could feed itself, but not with great variety. Perseverance and Spark conversed with an elderling named Harrikin. Seated beyond him was a girlish elderling. Sylve was pink and gold, with sparse hair but an intricate pattern of scalp scales. They were discussing fishing, and Sylv was unabashedly describing how difficult it had been to keep her dragon fed when they had journeyed from Treehog to discover Kelsengra. Lant was smiling and nodding, but his gaze often roved the room watchfully. To my right, Amber was seated next to Nortle. He was explaining that it was his dragon, Tinder, we had first encountered near the fountains. He hoped he had not seemed too aggressive. The dragons were unaccustomed to being surprised. Amber nodded and managed her utensils and food almost as if sighted. We ate. We drank. We endeavored to converse in that awkward way one does when attempting to speak loud enough to be heard over a dozen other conversations. Being in the thick of such an occasion was very different from spying on it from behind the wall. From a higher vantage point, I could have quickly deduced the alliances, rivalries, and enmities in the room. Trapped in the midst of it, I could only guess. I hoped that Lant, safely layered between me and our two servants, could politely avoid socializing and collect more information. The board was cleared. Brandy and a sweet wine were offered, and I chose the brandy. It was not Sand's Edge, but it was palatable. The elderlings rose from their seats and wandered the room, conversing, and we copied their behavior. Queen Malta came to apologize yet again and to hope that I was well recovered. Fron embraced me with the passion of his gratitude and his anger with General Rapscal's behavior. Twice I saw Rapscal angling toward me, only to be intercepted by one or another of the elderlings. We resumed our seats, and Harrikin rose. With his knuckles, he rapped on the table three times. Instantly, silence fell.
"Keepers, please welcome Prince Fitzchivalry, Lord Lant, and Lady Amber of the Six Duchies. They come as emissaries from King Dutiful and Queen Eliania. Tonight, we offer them a well-deserved welcome and our deepest thanks."
Plain words, no flowery speech, no reminders of past favors, treaties, and services. It took me aback, but Amber seemed to expect it. She rose in her place. Blind as she was, she still moved her unsighted gaze over her audience. Did she sense the body warmth emanating from their shadowy shapes? With unerring accuracy, she turned her face to Harrikin.
"Thank you for this welcoming meal and for your hospitality and for this opportunity to speak. I will be brief and to the point."
She allowed herself a smile.
"I suspect that since we first arrived, gossip has flown swiftly. I believe that most of you know our tale. It is true that we come as emissaries from the Six Duchies, but equally true that Kelsengra is not our destination. As Prince Fitzchivalry has restored some of your children to health, you can imagine what pain it would be to have a child stolen. B. Farseer is no more. When we leave you, it is to embark on a journey of vengeance against the servants of the Whites."
As Amber drew breath, Queen Malta interrupted in a low, soft voice.
"Lady Amber, if you would allow me to speak, please."
There was no rebuke in her voice, only a simple request. Amber was startled but gave a slow nod of agreement. The Queen took a deep breath and folded her hands on the tabletop.
"Yesterday we, the keepers of Kelsengra, met in our council. I shared your tale with them. The parents and some of the children spoke of what Prince Fitzchivalry did. We remain overwhelmed with gratitude and all agreed with what the prince said. The lives of our children are not bargaining points for us to haggle over. No amount of coin, no bartered favor from us could ever match what the prince did. We can only offer you undying thanks and our promise that we will always, forever remember. And we are a long-lived people now."
Malta paused and looked around.
"But you have also gifted us with a vengeance we have long sought. We, too, have endured Shale-Sed's destructive attacks on our dragons and on our kin. Shale-Sed's spies and killers sought to butcher dragons for their body parts, for remedies to preserve the life of their old duke. Selden, brother to me and beloved singer for our dragons, was brutalized there by both the Duke of Shale-Sed and Elic. We knew that Elic was instrumental in the attacks on our dragons, when the dragons took their vengeance on Shale-Sed, toppling the Duke's stronghold and killing him. Elic fled. The present Duchess of Shale-Sed will undoubtedly be as pleased as we are to hear that you've made an end of him. In killing him, you have satisfied our family's desire for vengeance. And that is a debt we are more than willing to pay. Thus Rain, born to the Cuprous family of the Rain Wild Traders, and I, born to the Vestrit family of the Bingtown Traders, well understand your desire to follow your vengeance to its final closure. We, as traders for the Cuprous and Vestrit families, are pleased to offer you like for like, aid in your vengeance for how you achieved ours. We have taken it upon ourselves to arrange your transport from here to Jamalia. If you are willing, you will board the Tarman when he docks here. The Tarman will carry you to Treehog, where the liveship Paragon will be waiting for you. He will carry you to Bingtown, and if you wish, to Jamalia on his trading run. A bird has already been sent to secure your passage. On behalf of our families, we hope you will accept our hospitality aboard these liveships.
Liveships? Perseverance breathed with a boy's awe. Are they truly real?
Fron grinned at the lad. We will let you judge that for yourselves. I forgot my promise to Amber. I am speechless, I said. Malta smiled, and I glimpsed the girl she once had been.
That's as well, for I have more to say. The keepers have other gifts they wish to bestow on you.
She hesitated for a moment.
These gifts are of elderling make. They are useful but also saleable, should your need be extreme.
She took a breath.
It ill behooves one to speak of the value of a gift, but I must make you aware that usually these items are only possessed by traders or sold through Bingtown for extremely large sums.
She folded her lips for a moment.
We break a long-standing tradition in gifting them to you. The traders of the Rain Wilds and of Bingtown would possibly be offended to know of this action.
Amber nodded, and her smile grew slowly.
We shall be very discreet in our possession of them, and they will not pass out of our custody save in direst need.
The relief on Malta's face was evident, even through her strange elderling beauty.
I am so grateful you understand.
She nodded, and Harrikin went to the door and spoke to someone outside. He received a tidy wooden chest and set it on the table before us. He opened the hinged lid and removed a bracelet from a cloth bag. Delicate silver links supported green and red stones. He presented it to me with a smile that warned me to be dazzled by its value.
It's beautiful, I said.
You don't know what it is,
he said in amusement. He slid it back into the bag and offered it to me.
Look inside.
When I peered into the open mouth of the bag, green and red light shone within.
They are flame jewels,
Malta informed us.
They gleam with their own light. The gems in the bracelet are perfect, very rare.
The other item he removed from the box looked like a porous grey brick. He showed us that it was painted red on one side. This block gives off warmth when you place it with the red side uppermost. Always take care to stow it with the grey side uppermost, for it becomes warm enough to start a fire.
He met my gaze and then restored both bracelet and brick to the wooden box. We hope you will accept these with our thanks.
You honor us, I replied. Magical items worth a king's ransom in one small box. We accept them with thanks and will always recall our visit here when we use them.
You are welcome to return at any time, Queen Malta assured us.
Amber set an appreciative hand on the box, her face set in determination.
As generous as you have been with us, there is still a boon I would ask. Before I name it, I beg you to know that we mean no offense by requesting it.
Puzzled glances were exchanged around the table. I had no idea what Amber sought. They had been generous with us beyond my wildest hopes. I wondered what more she could seek. Amber spoke in a soft, low voice.
I ask for dragon silver, not a great amount, only as much as would fill these two vials.
From a pocket in her skirt, she produced two glass containers, each with a tight-fitting stopper.
No,
Rain responded firmly, without hesitation or apology. Amber spoke on as if she had not heard him.
The skill, as we call the magic that Prince Fitzchivalry used to heal your children, is based in silver. We do not know exactly how the two are related, but they are. The magic of Kelsingrar comes from the silver trapped in the stone. The memories of the people who lived here, the lights that gleam from the buildings, the pools that warm the water, all of it comes from...
No, we cannot.
King Rain spoke with finality. The silver is not ours to give. It is the treasure of the dragons. He shook his head.
Even if we were to say yes, the dragons would not allow you to take it. It would be disastrous for you and for us. We cannot give you silver.
I saw Rapscal shift as if he would speak. The angry glints in his eyes said that he was affronted by her request. I needed to distance us from it. I spoke hastily. There is one other request I would make, one that might be easier for you to grant, one that could perhaps benefit Kelsingrar as well as the six duchies. I paused.
You may ask it,
Queen Malta decided. It was difficult to read her fantastically scaled countenance, but I thought that she, too, strove to move past the awkwardness. I would like to send a message to King Dutiful of the Six Duchies, to tell him that we have arrived safely here, and that you have offered to aid us on the next step of our journey. If I write out a letter for him, is there a way you can convey it for us?
Easily done,
Rain replied, visibly relieved at the simplicity of my request.
If you can write small, a bird can carry such a message to Bingtown. Bingtown has many merchants who exchange birds with Buckkeep Town. I will guarantee that it will reach your king, eventually. The winds of spring can slow our birds sometimes, but they are hardy creatures.
I would greatly appreciate this, I responded. I hesitated, and then plunged on. Shade would have forbidden it, but Ketrican would have required it. King Rain and Queen Malta, in my land, in my king's court, there are others who share my skill magic. Some are far more adept in the healing arts than I am. I looked around. There are folk here who ask that I help them. I dare not. The magic of the silver runs strongly in Kelsingrar, too strong for me to control. I would never have chosen to be so... I fumbled for a word. Violent? Unrestrained? Hasty in my healing of the children. A better healer than I could have been gentler. A full skill coterie with better control of the magic could help not just elderling children, but any folk who were born... They were staring at me. Born different, I said, my voice falling lower. They looked terrified, or stunned. Had I offended? The changes the dragon's presence had wrought in some of them were too obvious to ignore, but perhaps speaking of such was considered offensive. Timara spoke. She was seated nearby, but lifted her voice and her words carried clearly.
Those born changed could be healed of it?
Under the table, Amber gripped my leg in warning. I didn't need it. I would not promise what I was not certain was possible. Some could, I said. I think. Timara lifted her hands. I thought she would cover her face, but her cupped hands halted where she could stare at her fingers. She had black claws instead of nails. She tapped them against one another, pensively. The silence in the room shimmered with possibilities. Queen Malta spoke.
As soon as you can compose your letter...
Her voice choked and trailed off. Harrigan spoke suddenly.
Prince Fitzchivalry has offered us something that has been unimaginable.
He looked around the table at his fellows.
Perhaps we should be equally generous. We have always accepted that we were bound by the strictures of Bingtown and the Rain Wilds, that we could only trade in elderling goods in those markets. Perhaps it is time to discard that notion.
Malta looked shocked. Rain spoke slowly.
You suggest a break with a tradition that dates to the very founding of the Rain Wild settlements. Many of us feel we owe the Rain Wild traders little loyalty, and the Bingtown traders even less. On magical goods we must confer, but for other trade, I see no reason we must be bound.
Slow nods met his words. King Rain turned back to us.
Ancient maps in the city show that once roads connected Kelsingrar to the Mountain Kingdom. Perhaps it is time for us to renew those thoroughfares and truly become the traders we name ourselves.
The six duchies have many trade goods. Sheep and wool, grain we grow in plenty, cattle and leather, and iron also we have to trade. I smiled to cover my doubts. Would dutiful honor my impromptu negotiating?
Grain in plenty. Now there is something we could all celebrate. Within the month we will dispatch a trade delegation to Buckkeep. Shall we raise a toast to opening our borders?
More than one toast was raised that evening. Perseverance cheeks were flushed with wine when I saw Lantern Spark exchange a look. Spark put a hand to Purr's shoulder and steered him out of the festivities with dignity, if not with the steadiest of gait. A short time later, I pleaded fatigue, and Amber retreated with me, leaving Lant to represent the six duchies for the rest of that evening. As we made our slow ascent, she said quietly,
"Within King Rain's own family, there are people severely changed by the Rain Wilds in difficult ways. His sister..."
I knew what she was asking. Even for his sister, I do not dare.
"No, I was merely telling you of her. She is in Treehog now, visiting her family. Even if you were willing to take the risk, you could not. But if there are six duchies healers who could help the Rain Wilders, the six duchies could gain powerful allies."
I sat up until dawn creating my letter to King Dutiful. I composed my words, fully expecting that several people would read them before they reached him, if they ever did. I was circumspect, saying only that we had reached Kelsingrar and secured passage to Jamalia. I asked him to arrange passage home for Lant, Purr, and Spark, and told him that he might expect an ambassador from the dragon traders with a trade proposal. I added that it was imperative that Skillmistress Nettle be present for all negotiations. I wanted to say more. I dared not. I rolled my missive tightly, dipped it in wax, and pushed it into the small cylinder that would attach to a pigeon's leg. I wished I could skill a warning to Nettle. These dragon keepers claimed to be elderlings and heirs to this city,
and all its wonders. How would they respond if they knew of Eslavjarl and the battered treasures there? Would they attempt to claim them, or offer to pool their knowledge of that magic with ours? Shade would have seen a rivalry, Ketrikan, a natural alliance. Dutiful and Nettle? I did not know what they would see. I wondered if my use of the skill here had been the pebble that would trigger an avalanche of war, or become the first tiny block in building a shared legacy of magic. It was agonizing to say so little, and to know that it might be days before I could even attempt to reach out with the skill. The exact day of the Tarman's arrival was uncertain, for the river ran higher and swifter with the melting of distant snows. We each dealt with that waiting in our own way. The need to keep my skill walls tight and be ever vigilant against the current of skill and memories in the city wearied me. I took my meals within our chambers and graciously declined as many visitors as I could. The skill-induced weariness that assailed me meant that I seldom ventured out into the city. I remembered Kelsingrar as the deserted city I had first encountered on my quest to find Verity. It had been my first experience.